Welcome to the Young Entrepreneur's Journey with your host, Yasmina Ellens.
Welcome to the Young Entrepreneur's Journey, where we take the skills, mindset, and attitude needed to achieve any entrepreneurial endeavor, whether you're just starting out or you're already on your journey. And now, our host, Yasmina Ellens.
You are here today to learn from the best in business, entrepreneurship, and innovation. And today I have a real treat for you because I am chatting with Bill Corrigan, who joined the world leading consulting firm McKinsey as an expert associate partner in 2018, where he works with clients globally to drive digital transformation, specializing in Internet of Things, edge computing, public cloud, and advanced analytics, all these very impressive things. And having started his career at IBM, Bill then worked for a number of startups in various leadership roles, such as chief product officer and chief strategy officer. Bill no doubt has a vast wealth of entrepreneurial experience under his belt. And to top it off, Bill also restarted a failed startup that then sold to Microsoft for $300 million. That is insane. By the end of this interview, you will be equipped with the mindsets you need to make your entrepreneurial ventures a success. You will have the belief that you can carve out your own career path, and you will feel that you can accomplish any business goal that you set your mind to. With that said, thank you so much for coming on today, Bill. I'm so excited to chat with you.
Same here, Yasmina. I'd love to talk about entrepreneurship.
Perfect. So my first question for you is, what originally got you onto your entrepreneurial journey?
A couple things, I think, looking back at it. I always was a risk taker. And so, therefore, I always felt I could bet on myself. Even coming out of undergrad, I had worked as a financial analyst for an insurance company in Boston, and I'd gone to Boston University, and they offered me a full-time job, and it was a really good job. At the time, the job market was horrendous for undergrads coming out. So I turned it down, frankly, because, I felt that I didn't want to just be part of a cog in a big wheel. I really wanted to do something a little bit more interesting. And so I instead became a bartender in the Caribbean. So my parents were a little disappointed that that was the choice that I made. But no, I knew I had worked several jobs through undergrad and put myself through school and knew I needed to blow off a little steam before I really hunkered down and started with my career. So I wasn't worried about taking some time off to go do something fun. I felt like my youth, you only have your youth for a certain amount of time, so take advantage of it and take advantage of that freedom. So I did that, and then when I came back to reality after living in St. Thomas, I started to look around, and there weren't many jobs available, and was willing to do just about anything to break into technology. I knew this was the early 90s, and I felt like the technology was where I wanted to take my career eventually. And so ended up finding a job for Lotus Development, which was the maker of Lotus 1-2-3, which was the precursor to Microsoft Excel. And the only job they had was answering the phone in the middle of the night for tech support. And I said, fine, I'll do it. They gave me an increase in pay because I was working after hours, but it also gave me a lot more freedom and time when the phones would die down to actually learn new skills. So we were just coming out with a new product called Lotus Notes at the time, and I saw the manual there. I installed it on my computer and quickly became one of the experts within Lotus of Lotus Notes, which was a brand new product nobody knew. So I sort of took that and became one of the company's notes experts at the age of 23.
Wow, that's really impressive. And what did it take for you to think? I mean, my first question is, what did it take for you to think that you could actually go out and take risks and that you could bet on yourself? What gave you that belief that you could do that?
Right. So a couple of things. One is, always thinking about what's the worst that could happen? You know, like even when I moved to St. Thomas, I'm like, if I move down there and I don't find a job or I don't find where I want to be, well, I get a great vacation out of it for 3 or 4 weeks and then I come home. Same thing with taking a chance of not accepting that job coming out of undergrad. It was like, all right, well, I've always been resourceful. I'm a smart person. I feel like I can scratch out a living doing something. I feel pretty confident that I can add value to lots of different situations. And then just, I think that St. Thomas experience also gave me a ton of confidence throughout my early career. No matter how bad it got, I always felt like, hey, I could always buy a $400 flight back to St. Thomas and be a bartender. So it sort of gave me like, hey, if that's the worst case scenario that's going to happen to me when I'm 25, well, that's not a bad thing. So I think a lot of it is we get very wrapped up sometimes about thinking about like, oh, I've got to succeed. I've got to do this. But it's like the failure part isn't so bad, you know, especially if it's failure, meaning like, hey, I tried to start a company and it didn't work out. Yeah, that didn't work out. But what you learned, you may have learned 30 valuable lessons that now you're going to take to your next startup. And I think that's one of the things that for me, trying to be in the moment a lot more, and I couldn't do this when I was 25, but now that I'm in my 50s, I can do this. I understand the value of being in the moment. So you're not like, oh my God, what if something doesn't happen? It's like, enjoy the moment that you're in, enjoy, no matter how arduous it is or how much of you hate it. You know, like last week I was working until 3 o'clock in the morning, a couple nights on a couple of different client studies. No one really wants to work till 3 o'clock in the morning, but the value I got out of it, we honed some really nice diamonds for our client and it felt great doing that. So that's part of it too, is just, you know, being confident in yourself and being able to understand that whatever you decide, you can always sort of undo it at a later time. And worst case scenarios are really not that bad most of the time.
Yeah, I think when you come to peace with the worst case scenario, that takes a lot of pressure off. And I think what you say about living in the present is so key, because so many people are caught up in, oh my God, the future. And there's all this anxiety about what will happen, or there's this anxiety about what happened in the past. But as Eckhart Tolle, who wrote The Power of Now, says, the game of life is played in the present. And once you really come to peace with what's happening now, then you can really start to enjoy the adventure, which I think is really awesome. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. So it sounds like you've jumped into a lot of different projects. You work with a lot of different startups. And it sounds like early on, you understood the value of, well, let me become an expert in this thing.
Right.
So that then I am the point of authority in the port of call, and people are going to come to me because now I've learned this to mastery, and then you can take that mastery elsewhere.
Right.
So I'm wondering, where did this come from, this desire to just learn different things and apply it in lots of different contexts?
So, I mean, that's just intellectual curiosity. I've always been enticed to sort of products, building products, using products. I've always been interested in you know, the things that I like to use, whether it's a particular type of mobile phone or what a particular type of bicycle. How do they engineer it? How do they know how to build it? And so I always kind of gravitated to that. I started, as I mentioned, at Lotus, and then we got acquired by IBM, and it was a lot of fun going through that acquisition, but then I also realized I didn't want to be part of such a giant organization. So that's when I first left Lotus to go to a startup. But I also wanted to just be able to have a better purview into all of the aspects of running a business. So going to a startup, we were a 14-person company and I was the chief product officer. It gave you an opportunity to do everything. So pricing strategy and who are the partners we need to talk to? What are the product features? How do we service the customer? How do you market it? So it gave, you know, one of the things I've always loved about sort of being on the product management side of things is you're almost like the CEO of a product, and you're figuring out exactly how useful it is in different settings. And what you do is in a successful startup is you really need to assimilate your customer's perspective. So whether you're building, you know, a bicycle or building systems management tools for desktop administrators, which is one of the things I did in my past, you need to put yourself into their shoes and understand their day-to-day activities and what are the challenges that they face. And then once you can do that effectively, then it becomes really evident of what you need to do to either build the right product for them or deliver it to them through the right means and market it the right way. And it becomes kind of a fairly mundane exercise after that point. But it, I think a lot of people miss that point of like, how do you assimilate that perspective of that target customer, as opposed to working from a product out? Like so many engineers come up with a great idea. I was just on the phone yesterday with three brilliant engineers from a large technology company. And they were explaining to me this really cool new file system that they had developed and all that. And my first question was, okay, what's the benefit? You know, who uses this and what's the benefit? And they could not give me one use case. And so my homework assignment for them was, go back and think about why you gestated this idea in the first place. What were the problems you were trying to solve and what settings? And then be able to write that down on one piece of paper and then come back and we'll start to have a conversation about whether your company should invest more in this and how it would fit into your broader product portfolio. So.
Definitely. I think people can get so wrapped up in an idea and get so excited about the idea that they can forget about the target market and who is it serving and what problem does it solve and what are the pain points?
Will they pay for it? That's a big one. It's like, we often ask this question with our clients. It's like, okay, these are all interesting ideas, but are they, you know, we'll go through multiple analyses of sort of how to determine whether something has value or not for the target customer. But oftentimes that's what it comes down to. It might not be the best idea, but it's the idea that customers are willing to pay for.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think what's really interesting about that target market research is you can have a lot of people say, oh yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Awesome. Right. And then you're like, cool, why don't you buy one? They're like, you know, and it's like that proof of payment is right. such a key thing. Yeah. Right. I'm wondering, because you've jumped on so many different startups, you worked on so many different things, you're absorbing all these different, you're applying so many things across industry. I think the exciting thing about in startups, as you said, is you have to get your hands dirty and you have to basically learn everything because it's so small and right. you're building an idea from the ground up. I've heard that there's a very interesting story behind how you got involved with Softricity. So I'd love to hear that story.
So Softricity was a restart. So it was funded as a company called Software Wow out of the Boston Computer Museum and was designed to be a streaming game platform for the computer museum itself. So rather than them having to go out and touch the different computers around the museum, they could have a centralized server that would stream games out to them, and then the games would run on those computers. And then they thought they could take that to a broader gaming platform across the internet. Took a ton of funding, about $30 million, and it failed miserably. And I just happened to be lifting weights one day with a gentleman at a gym, and I was in between jobs. My other startup had failed, and so he mentioned, we were just talking about what we do, and he said, he goes, oh, so you're like a product person. You understand how to like build products. I said, sometimes. And he goes, we have this company we've invested in. Would love to have you take a just quick look at them. Would you meet the CTO? I said, sure. So I went into their office on a Saturday. I met their CTO, who was this brilliant guy named Stuart Schaefer, who had come out of MIT. And Stuart had built an amazing set of technologies for this startup, but they were not solving a problem that somebody would pay for, going back to that point. So he and I sat there on a Saturday whiteboarding out exactly what the technology did. And it really dawned on me then that I said, well, Stuart, if you could do this, if you could virtualize a game, could you also virtualize, say, Microsoft Word? He said, oh, yeah, it's the same types of executables and DLLs and whatnot. I said, well, that's a problem that I see in the corporate world all the time. And I knew it from my Lotus Notes days, that our Lotus Notes client would get installed on a computer and break it like so often. And so I knew Windows applications had this inherent problem of breaking computers. I said, I think that's a big problem that we could solve. And so it was sort of like his brilliant technology sort of acumen mixed with my understanding of the market coming together. Now, all of a sudden, it was like, all right, now we know what we want to be. And so we put a stake in the sand of like, we're going to work on every single Windows application. We had a VP of engineering who was very risk averse. So what he had said was, well, we can do like certain apps, but we can't do all apps. And I'm like, Bob, that's not gonna get us to the huge valuation. Nobody's gonna pay us a lot of money to solve one or two applications for them. They will pay us a lot of money if we can solve all of their Windows applications. So I put a stake in the sand. I joined the company. I put a stake in the sand and said, we are going to solve this for every single Windows application. And some of the engineers quit because they thought it was too hard of a problem to solve. But we had a couple of real rock star people too that said, you know what? Even though we can't do it right now, I think we can. I think we can eventually get there. And we iterated and we tested, and the first few customers blew up in our face. But eventually we got there to the point where you had critical mass. And it was really, you know, and you start with one customer and you literally do everything you can for that one customer. And then you learn, and then you do a couple more, and you start to build that base of early adopters. That is, you know, your classic. If you ever read like Jeffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm, you always have that early adopters. But then the big leap is crossing over to the mainstream customers that are willing to buy it on a, you know, continual basis.
Definitely. I'm really curious because it sounds like there was a lot of persistence involved, right? And it's interesting because when you're in the startup world, things fail. Sometimes things don't go the way you want to. I mean, most of the time things fail, and then you've got to iterate, and then you've got to improve, and then you've got to test. How do you know when to pivot? How do you know when to persist? And how do you know when it's just like, maybe it's time to give up on this one and work on something new?
Right. Good point. Those are great questions. I mean, the first thing is you need to be at a startup or any type of entrepreneurial effort. You need serious intestinal fortitude. And you also need to be able to have the mentality of in US baseball, we have this concept of a closer. And the closer is the guy that comes in to pitch the last inning of a game to close it out. And so as the closer, you have a ton of pressure on you. And if you fail, if you give up a home run one day, well, the next day they're going to bring you in to try and close the game out again. You can't be thinking about yesterday's home run that you gave up. You have to be thinking, I'm going to dominate in this scenario. And that's the mentality you kind of have to have, because when I advise a lot of younger people at McKinsey who are looking to leave McKinsey to go out into industry. And I said, the first thing you need to understand is that most of your experience when you're at a startup is pretty miserable. Like you're working really hard. You're trying to do everything right, but there's so many forces that are against you that, you know, over the course of a week, 90% of your experience might be negative, but that little 10% is what gets you like excited about the next week. You know, so I'll give you an example. At Softricity, we had a large software company that was exploring our software, as they were saying, hey, you know, we want to buy you guys. And this was probably 2 years into it. We're all excited. We worked with them. They signed a non-disclosure and all that. They took our software away for a month. And part of the agreement was they had to give us a detailed analysis of what they thought of it at the end. Well, they sent us a half-page note about their analysis, and we didn't hear from them for a week. And then a week later, we saw a press release that they were announcing a product that was exactly our product. So that this was a big publicly traded company, and now they had stolen our ideas under the auspices of they were going to think of buying us. And now pre-announced the exact product that we had. And so it was like, you know, next thing you know, our investors are in a panic and all that kind of thing. And really, it was my, it was our management team that really said, you know, yeah, you know what's great about that? They're going to create more excitement about this market than we ever could have done with our little tiny marketing budget. And yet we're going to be so laser focused on solving the customer problem because this is the only thing we do. We're going to be better than them. So they're going to create bake-off situations. And so we kept everybody internally from panicking and kept going. And that's exactly how it played out. This other company created all kinds of marketing materials and they did webinars and they never had a product. And eventually, 2 years later, they came back to try to buy us at 10 times the price that it would have cost them 2 years earlier. And they ended up losing out to Microsoft in that scenario because Microsoft was then interested.
Yeah, I think it's so fascinating, right? It's like, it just goes to show how you can have an idea. And I think a lot of people try and keep their ideas under lock and key because of copycats and potential competitors and stuff like that. But if you have that laser focus like you guys did, and you know that, you know, we are the people who are going to be able to execute and implement on this best, I think it's so interesting how something that seemed like a potentially disastrous situation turned around like you for that.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. McKinsey, we talk about, the Goliaths need to think like an entrepreneur and how fast can they pivot to being an entrepreneur? Whereas the entrepreneurs need to get to scale as fast as possible. And so there's this competition going on between the incumbents and the entrepreneurs. And so, you know, both can win, but they have to do a pivot. The small entrepreneurial company needs to get to scale quickly. And that big behemoth needs to figure out how to not be so bureaucratic and slow moving and be able to adapt. And so it's a hard problem to solve.
Definitely. I'd love to know, what did it take for you to get it to the point where Microsoft was now interested and eventually sold to them for $300 million?
It really came down to a couple things. One was part of what we did right from the start was had good engineering hygiene. So we would try to do things right from an engineering architecture perspective, even if it took a little bit longer to do it. So instead of just rushing features to market, we wanted to make sure that our platform was scalable. So that was actually one of the main reasons why Microsoft, our acquisition flew through very quickly in their due diligence process. But the big thing was establishing ourselves as a leader in a brand new category. And the way you do that is, you know, there's some marketing involved and we always had tiny marketing budgets, but we were very, we used guerrilla marketing quite a bit. We would leverage other technology companies and sort of be part of their booth, for instance, instead of buying our own booth at a trade show. We would do a ton of webinars and seminars to educate people about, it was all around desktop management and managing desktops and securing them and things. So we would do a lot of free webinars for that. And ultimately it was about building a customer base. So, you know, Microsoft started to hear from Merrill Lynch and some of these other big Bank of America and other big companies that were using our tool. And Microsoft at first looked at us as a competitor to their System Center Configuration Manager product, which allowed you to deploy applications. And so one of the things that we did that that really worked in our favor was instead of making them feel like they were an adversary, I embraced what they were building. So I came out with an extension that we said, this is the Softricity extension for Microsoft System Center Config Manager. So it was vaporware. We didn't have it. All we had was a PowerPoint. But I started to do webinars about how you could continue to keep your System Center intact, and we would run in conjunction with it, and we would solve the problem of virtualizing applications. And at that point, all of a sudden, the product managers from Microsoft and Brad Anderson, who was the head of their System Center team, started to call us and say, hey, this is really interesting. We'd like to learn a little bit more. And we started to have some conversations with them. And then, you know, we were kind of going along with a nice relationship. We were part of their partner program. We would show up at their conferences. And they would kind of whisper in us like, yeah, you guys are still a little too small for us. But, you know, maybe at some point in the future, we could think about, you know, acquisition. But the other company I was talking about, I don't want to mention their name, but the other company that had tried to buy us all of a sudden came in with an unsolicited bid to buy the company. And we went back to Microsoft and said, hey, you know, we're not going to be around a year from now because our board is going to accept this offer. And Microsoft made it happen. Over the course of 2 weeks, we had five or six different offers from both companies, and they kept going back and forth. And Microsoft finally, the funny story was that the CEO of the other acquiring company had an overnight flight to Japan, and he was on a plane, and they were also very tied to Microsoft, so Microsoft talked to them on a regular basis. Well, the Microsoft knew that this gentleman was jumping on a plane. There was no internet connectivity back then, and they sent us a final offer and said, here's our final offer. You have a half hour to sign this, and if you don't sign it, it's fine. We'll still be partners with you, but if you do sign it, we're gonna acquire you. And so it was such a great offer that we signed it, and the other gentleman got off the plane in Japan and found out he had lost out on the bid.
Wow, it's crazy how things can happen so fast in business. Right. Yeah, I think it was so smart, the move that you made to reframe the competition to collaboration, definitely. Right. And what you talked about leads me to ask, because obviously when you have a startup, you build something, you sell something, or you partner with companies, or M&As happen, all these kinds of things. And I know you've been involved in that kind of stuff. So I'm really curious to hear from your perspective, what in your opinion makes a good deal? How do you build a good deal, and how can you land good deals, and how can you negotiate a good deal?
Right. Good point. You know, it's funny. I always have a saying that I come up with that says, you know, good companies are bought, they're not sold. And what I mean by that is you build a great company that is, you know, too often companies start with the idea that we're going to IPO, or we're going to be sold. We're going to, you know, here are the three or four companies that could acquire us. And that's 100% the wrong mentality to have, because now you're working toward that one financing event as opposed to building a great company. And so, yeah, you might get the company sold, but will it be the right valuation that you should have had? Would it be to the right suitor for the culture of your employees? And I did some consulting about 10 years ago for a company in the UK, and you know, this was after we had sold Softricity to Microsoft, and after I'd left Microsoft, and the CEO said, "Bill, how do we get sold?" And I told her, you know, you don't. You build a great company. Go back to the basics of what does the customer need? How do you build a big cadre of customers and a big base? Then, you know, that's when people start getting interested in you. So then it gets to the point where you can pick and choose. You could say, we're independent. We're doing well without you. You know, and so you don't the best time to sell the company is when you don't have to sell the company. And oftentimes too, it just comes down to, you know, in the case of Softricity, what I was looking at was, we were selling an average desktop product for about $200 per desktop. I knew that this was such a critical piece of infrastructure for Microsoft that whether they bought us or not, they were going to need to do something in this space. And so as soon as they would announce something, our price was going to go from $200 to $20 per, you know, so it would have meant for us to hit our numbers, we would have to do 10x the volume. And there was just no way we were going to be able to do that. So to me, that final year that it was our fourth year in business, I knew it was the turning point of we either make it or break it. And if we make it, it's going to be a great successful exit. If we break, it's going to probably still be an exit, but it's going to be pennies on the dollar kind of thing. And so that's what we knew at that point, that the market was aligning and such that it also was something that companies were starting to demand that you have the types of resources for support that we could not provide as a little 100-person company at that point. So it became very evident for us at that point. I was at another company that we, you know, my first startup that I left Lotus for. We had a great product. It was just way ahead of its time. It was an intranet in a box for small to medium businesses. People didn't even know what intranets were at that point. We had come out of Lotus. We'd been building intranets for people with Lotus Notes. And now all of a sudden, you know, we're trying to target small to medium businesses. 10 years later, there's, you know, the concept of Slack and things like that that are multi-billion dollar valuations. And we ended up having to, you know, just close that company down because we couldn't get enough people interested in it.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting what you said about building a really good company and building a really high quality product that customers are excited about. You understand your customer inside out, and then you get to the point where you don't need anything from anyone.
Right.
And then that's the point where it's the best time to start selling. I thought that was a really, really interesting approach.
Right. Yeah. And the other thing is the culture. You know, I mean, like I said, so many negative things happen from the external externalities during the course of a startup that you need to have a good culture inside. If you have any kind of infighting or the, you know, us versus them, like engineering team versus product versus sales, you're not going to be successful. So a lot of it comes back to the leadership and having sort of that guiding, you know, guiding light of like, we're going to be successful. Yeah, we're going to hit some hiccups along the way, but we all need to work together. And I think also making sure that you have regular, like, company-wide meetings, like a monthly basis at a minimum when you're a small company. And so everybody can air things out, and you don't get these little pockets of fiefdoms around. Even a small company, you can start to have some infighting, especially when things aren't going well. People will look for excuses or people will look to point fingers. And so you got to make sure that everybody is pulling in the same direction. And the best way to do that is to give people as much information as possible. So we used to share, you know, in our monthly meetings within Softricity, we would show the books to everybody. We'd show, here's how much financing we have. Here's what our monthly burn rate is. Here's what we're doing from a sales perspective. So everybody knew exactly sort of where we were. We didn't keep people in the dark. And I think, you know, when you're dealing with smart, intelligent employees, that's what you want. You want to entrust them to do their job, but you also want to give them the right information.
Definitely. Yeah, I'm really curious as to what you have to say when it comes to, like, in your opinion, what makes a really good leader?
Yeah, there's lots of things. I mean, the whole concept of servant leadership has become, you know, very popular, and I'm a big believer in it. And we do teach this to many of our clients at McKinsey. Is really, as a leader, you need to be able to define a clear vision of where you want to take, whether it's a company or your department within a company, and have clearly defined set of initiatives that are supporting your ultimate goals, that support your ultimate vision. And so if you're head of marketing, are your marketing programs aligned with the overall vision for the company? And are you working toward those goals? So first, the first and foremost is making sure that there's this clear communication of what the overall vision and goals are for the company. The other is removing obstacles for people, whether it's, you know, hiring obstacles or, you know, in the case of Softricity, we had an excellent CEO. He didn't know much about the operational side of the business, but what he did very well was he kept the board away from us. He kept the funding at a level that we never had to starve the business, and the board never got, you know, too far into our day-to-day business. And I've seen that happen where, you know, the boards, they want to help, or the investors want to help, and they don't particularly help. They just get in the way because they ask the very obvious questions that you've already asked 100 times ahead of time, and you've already figured out why that's not going to work. So he did a really nice job of shielding us from that. And then, you know, whenever anything bad would happen to us, this gentleman, Harry Ruta, he would just say, we're going to be a super successful software company. I know we will. We have the right people. And just having that confidence in us helped us, you know, and The other thing is, from a leadership perspective, being humble, you know, and really humility goes a long way, both with your employees and your customers. Nobody wants to deal with an arrogant CEO or an arrogant company itself. Eventually, they say, you know what, we have other alternatives. So those are a couple of the attributes. The other thing is just from a work ethic, you know, everybody needs to be sort of pulling in the same direction. If you have certain teams that are not, you know, you have certain teams that are working 80-hour weeks and others that are working 40, that's going to cause friction. So you need to figure out why are the people working 80? You know, first of all, that's not sustainable over a long period of time. And then, you know, are there others that need to be doing a little bit more? And that's sort of, you know, making sure that the culture and the way of working is working throughout the company. I think Amazon does a very nice job of this with their leadership development principles. And when they interview people, they really, you know, look for that cultural fit and are you willing to put the customer first and those kinds of things.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of really powerful insights in there. So much to unpack. I think what you said about the vision is so important and that everyone is aligned with that vision. And then also the belief. When mm-hmm. the leader has belief, then the employees or the people working around the leader will also have belief because the leader has the belief. The leader doesn't have the belief, then no one else is going to believe in it. The customers aren't going to believe in it. I think it's such an important insight.
Right. And sometimes you have to put a game face on, too. I mean, there were times, not just at Softricity, but other companies where I've been like, holy cow, I don't know how we're going to be successful here. But I had to go in front of my team and put that game face on and say, you know, here's the positives, here's the negatives. And I think the positives far outweigh the negatives. And I'm willing to work as hard as I possibly can to overcome some of the headwinds that we might have. And, you know, I think people appreciate that too, that if you're willing to roll up your sleeves, and it goes back to that concept of servant leadership, you know, you don't want to just delegate things and have people working, you know, millions of hours without you also getting in the trenches with them and doing it. And that's really important.
Definitely. Definitely. And I think also as a leader and someone who's in the world of business and entrepreneurship, you end up meeting and dealing with a lot of people. And so given that, I'm really curious if you have any particular philosophies or approaches when it comes to building relationships with people.
Right, right. Yeah, it's funny because, you know, there's a big push around diversity and inclusion, obviously, throughout business these days. And for me, it's never been an issue in that I find each person fascinating, and each person has their own set of talents and they can bring so much to the table. And what I found, especially when you're at a startup, when you're starting, say, with four people, when you add that fifth person, you're now increasing your capacity by 25% of the company, right? So it's amazing when you add somebody who's good at what they do, whether it's like a few years ago, I was running marketing for a tiny little company and we added in a social media marketing person who was really good at just creating social media programs. And the value that she was able to bring was just amazing, you know, and like incrementally just saw like the company got that much bigger and that much better. And so a lot of it comes down to that. And like I said, too, appreciating people's different perspectives. So you have people, you know, and this is one of the things I love about McKinsey is that we have people from, you know, Imperial College. We have people from, like myself, I went to Boston University. We have computer science people. We have, you know, people who come from industry. We have all different types of people that come together to solve problems. And I'm always amazed when we bring, you know, I might think I already have a problem solved and I have my 10 bullet points listed out. And then we do a brainstorming session, you know, we call them problem solvings. And there's 15 other things that I never thought of because it just didn't cross my purview at all. And I think that's also a culture. If you can create a culture where people are willing to speak up and bring ideas, to the table, that's also really amazing. At Microsoft, we had a thing called Think Week, where everybody in the company can come up with an idea. And you put your idea down on paper, and Bill Gates would actually read through the top 50 to 100, depending on the year, and get, and you'd actually get a chance to present your idea to Bill Gates. And I love that sort of culture of like anybody in the company can come up with a good idea, and let's continue to encourage that so that people don't feel like, oh, well, that's not my department. You know, I've seen engineers that came up with some great marketing ideas. In fact, some of my best marketing programs came out of a conversation I had with an engineer. So it's very strange how that can happen.
Yeah, I think it's incredible how you have that diversity of skill sets, which is really what breeds innovation, and the diversity of perspectives. And when someone can take a fresh look at a problem and see it in a completely different light, I think, if I remember correctly, I think it was Disney as well that had that kind of approach where literally anyone in the company, all the way down to the cleaners, could right. pitch any idea, which I think is incredible because that is what drives innovation.
Yeah, yeah. It's, kind of, it's, if you look back to that idea of like the shared vision, there's a pretty famous medical center in the U.S. called Mayo Clinic. And if you read leadership books, you'll often see Mayo Clinic cited. I read a book about leadership where they went into one of the operating rooms after the end of the day, and there was a woman in there cleaning, and they said she was amazing. She did this amazing cleaning job of the operating rooms. And when they interviewed her, they said, so what makes you so motivated? She goes, I'm saving people's lives. Because she had been shown how important it is for her to have those operating rooms ready for the doctors who are performing the emergency operations. And if she doesn't do her job right, then the doctors can't do theirs. They can't save lives. And so they had taught that sort of culture of how every job is super important. And it's like, I love that idea too, of like, you don't just hire people for some random reason. There's always a reason why somebody is taking a specific role on, and it all is equally as important.
I love that. That is so interesting. I love how you can tie the tiniest cog in the wheel to the big vision right. and make it important and relevant as well. That is right. so interesting. I'm conscious of time. I would love to know more about you, and what are some of the, I've heard that you like to talk about the idea of pre-made choices, and I'm curious to know what kind of pre-made choices or rules, you know, do you have for your life that set you up for success?
For me, it's about, you know, I've always had a ridiculous work ethic. Even when I was a little boy, I started working at a flower shop at the age of 6 years old and used to work there, you know, like 8 hours on a Saturday, 8 hours on a Sunday, and, weeding and things like that. So I've always had a good engine from a work ethic perspective, which I think is just, you have to have that to be successful. The other thing is, we had some tragedy in my family early on. I had a brother that died in a boating accident. And I think that kind of, and I was very young. I was only 4 years old when it happened, but I saw the downstream ramifications to my family. And I think that put a lot of things in perspective for me, that life is very short. It's such a cliche, but we're only here for a certain amount of time. So try to take advantage of every situation you're presented, whether it's an opportunity to work for a startup or an opportunity to go to an elite university, taking advantage of that, of those gifts that you're given, and putting them to the fullest, stretching it to the fullest is key for me. I always feel like I've been blessed with lots of great opportunities, but I also look back and I created a lot of those opportunities for myself by working hard or studying or doing the right things of understand, like the case of Lotus Notes. I saw that's sort of a future, so I invested the time to do it. While at the same time, just having a ton of fun along the way. Like I'm very much an extrovert, so I do make friends easily, and I have friends all around the world. But I also value lots of different cultures, so I love having friends in Portugal and China, and lots of friends in, you know, throughout the United States, and being a little bit more well-rounded like that, I think helps me. It helps me cope. And then finally, just like having really strong relationships with my wife and with some good friends. I still have friends from when I was in high school that I talk to on a weekly basis, and bounce ideas off of. I think having those bonds really helped me a lot.
I think that those long-term relationships, that long-term loyalty, can be really powerful. It's like you can't make an old friend. You know? Right. You can't like newly make an old friend. It doesn't work. Yeah, that's really incredible. I totally agree that it's so important to have fun along the way. Otherwise, you know, what's the point? Life is short, as you say.
Right. And the thing is too, like, find, it sounds like it's not one of these cliches I'm going to throw at you, but find what you love to do. And try to pursue that. So whether you're, you know, a consultant working at McKinsey and finding the right tribe to attach yourself to and be part of that practice, or whether you're an entrepreneur, I just had breakfast with an entrepreneur here in Boston. He's a former McKinsey person last week, and he had 5 or 6 ideas. And he's like, I think this one would be viable, and I think this one would be viable. And he had 3 or 4 different ones. And I was like, you know, which one are you passionate about? Which one do you think you'd get excited, you know, going in at 5 o'clock in the morning and working on it? And he's like, well, none of them. I said, then don't do them. Like, yeah, they're all perfectly viable business opportunities, but unless you have that passion, you're not going to be able to withstand like the rigor and all those downtimes. Eventually you're just going to say, this isn't worth it for me. So you got to find that thing that you're really passionate about. And it might not even be the most lucrative opportunity, but it's something you're passionate about. But, you know, it's something you're going to get excited about doing on a day-to-day basis with the people that you want to do it with, too. And then that's so important, finding the right partners and finding the right mentors and finding the right investors. That's, you know, that's why it's so hard to be successful as a startup, because all these things need to sort of come together.
Yeah. It's only when you have the passion, the people, and all of those different elements combined that you can really be fulfilled and enjoy the journey every day and be excited about it. Even on those days that are hard, you still believe in the bigger vision.
Yeah,
that's awesome. I think that's a great segue for me to go into my final question for you, Bill, which is, what are 3 key truths about the entrepreneurial journey that you would share with the young entrepreneur today?
All right, 3 key truths. For one thing, don't get discouraged by short-term setbacks. Having that even keel sort of longer-term vision is tantamount to success. The second is going back to my point about assimilating the customer's perspective. You can never know too much about your customer. And this is actually something we do in part of our, what we call LEAP practice at McKinsey, where we help companies build digital businesses. Within the first 2 or 3 days, we've already developed a hypothesis, and we're testing that hypothesis with customers and voice of the customer interviews, and you start to get that feedback immediately. It was amazing to me when I joined Microsoft and I took over several product teams. I had some product managers who had never spoken to a customer, and I said, "How can you possibly do your job if you?" They're like, "Well, you know, I read books and I read reports from our sales team." I'm like, "You got to talk to the customers." And they're like, "Well, we don't have a travel budget." I'm like, "I don't care, you know. We're Microsoft. We're here in Puget Sound. We have 3,000 customers in Puget Sound driving distance. You don't need to get on a plane. We have an executive briefing center across the street." So I actually forced part of our quarterly commitments. I forced people to do at least 3 customer briefings per quarter, because I wanted them to get that firsthand customer knowledge. So customer understanding your customers is so important. And probably the third one I would say is about culture and being respectful of everyone within the organization. And if there are people that are not respectful of that culture, being able to call them out and confront them about it, because culture, lack of culture or any kind of infighting has, I've seen, kill great companies, great ideas, great companies, that it can be so invasive. Those are probably the three that I would mention.
Really important takeaways, especially about the customer as well, because your customer will tell you what they want. They will show you what they want. Really powerful. Thank you so much, Bill. You clearly have so much experience under your belt. This has been extremely enlightening. This would be your opportunity to plug anything that you'd like to plug that would be worth plugging, or where can people find you?
Sure. Well, happy to have follow-on conversations with yourself, Yasmina, or others. They can always find me on LinkedIn, Bill Corrigan at McKinsey. Always willing to help people think through ideas or think through career paths and things like that. At this point in my career, I get far more self-actualization and enjoyment from helping others succeed than my own. I'm kind of at the point where I'm very happy where I am. I have a great wife. We have a great life, and I really want to help others achieve their goals and dreams.
Definitely, and make an impact. That's really incredible. It's really incredible. Well, thank you so much, Bill. I've had an absolute blast chatting to you.
Yeah, me too. Thanks, Yasmina.
Do you ever feel like you put on a front to the world? I did an episode for this podcast with my friend Will Nedder a while back called How to Hack Yourself and Live Life to the Fullest. And we were talking all about how many, many people bottle up their emotions. They mask their true feelings and their true selves with a fake smile. Firstly, because going through hard times is not something that people typically want to hear about. And secondly, because they're afraid to show the world their true colors. One thing that I really love is that Will likes to ask people, how are you really doing? Not how are you doing, but how are you really doing? Because that then gives them permission to open up, unburden, and be unashamedly themselves and feel lighter and more liberated in the aftermath. And one day Will himself was actually going through a tough time, and he confessed to the person he was speaking to in that moment, I'm just low-key emotional. I just put on a front all the time. To which the immediate reply was, you should totally put that on a t-shirt. And boom, the low-key emotional streetwear brand was born. Will's passion for his brand truly oozes through in everything he does, and he essentially created this as a call to authenticity. A lot of us put on a front for the world of how we want the world to think about us instead of who we really are. We hide these parts of ourselves from others out of a fear that we will be judged negatively by others or that we won't be accepted for the person that we really are. So I want to ask you, what's your front? At the end of the day, the low-key emotional brand is all about facing your truth. So if you want to wear clothes like a hoodie, a cap, a bikini that actually stand for something real and keep your hustle low-key, I have an exclusive offer just for you as my podcast listener. With me, you get a 10% discount using the discount code YAS10. That's YAS10 at the checkout at lowkeyemotional.com. All of the links and the details are in the show notes. I gotta say, I have their hoodie myself. It's extremely comfortable. It looks incredibly hip. I love wearing it. And so if you're one of the cool kids, this is most definitely for you. Again, you can get a 10% discount using the discount code YAS10. That's YAS10 at the checkout at lowkeyemotional.com. And you too will be rocking the street look in no time. Again, all of the details are in the show notes.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Young Entrepreneur's Journey. This episode is recorded in London by Yasmina Ellens. The music for the show, as well as the editing, is done by Jake Babineau. If you've gotten anything out of this podcast, please consider sharing it with a friend or liking it in the iTunes store. These things help more than anything else in reaching a broader audience, and in turn, will lead to better episodes for you to listen to. Thanks again, and we'll see you in the next episode.